I'm not a regular preacher, probably of any kind, to be honest with you. Number one, I stand down here when I preach. There's a couple of reasons why I do that, and it's been a while since I've described this for some folks. Some of y'all may be new. I have an imbalance issue, and for whatever reason, being up there really, truly messes with that, and so my thought is it's probably better for me to stand down here than to fall up there. That would probably distract from the lesson somewhat. Other thing is, I just simply like, really, being down here. This is kind of really my, more of my comfort level. I was thinking when Brian asked me on Friday night if I would fill in for George, I was trying to remember how long it's been since I've done a sermon. It's been a while. It's not because it's something I don't necessarily enjoy doing. In fact, I kind of like it. It's okay. I would rather teach a class that's, again, more my, since that's what I do for a living, I guess that kind of makes sense. That is more my comfort level. But this is something that I enjoy doing as well. So, with that being said, let's talk about what we're going to talk about today. If you happen to have been here over the weekend, and if you weren't, you missed some good stuff. Even if you're not married, the lessons that were given were worthwhile for an individual to hear. And that was what I was hoping was going to happen this weekend. A couple of people asked me, are you coming this weekend? Because this is really a seminar for married people, people who are going to get married. And that's something I really, at this point in my life, don't think is going to happen. And that's okay. It really is, I promise, okay. So I'm an alright guy. So there was the discussion of whether or not, and my thought was, yeah, I think it's probably something I'll do because I'm going to think there's going to be some value. Number one, just being with other Christians. Having the opportunity to spend time with the members here, the one, I think is some value there. But also what my assumption was, it was going to be really a discussion about relationships. And I think we can all learn some things about relationships. Maybe it will help me understand what goes on sometimes in the lives of my married friends that I don't experience in my own personal life. So I thought there were some things that would be of value of that, and there were. There were some things that I learned from that, some things I hadn't thought of necessarily in ways that he presented them. If you happen to have been here last Sunday and you heard George's lesson, you're going to hear some repeats from both of those a little bit. One is because I've only had since Friday to get a lesson ready, and these are the things that were kind of on my mind. Two, these are some things that I think we need. So let's first look at all, if you would, go ahead and turn to Matthew, the 22nd chapter. I kind of probably should have known right off the bat that Brother Fontenot's lessons were going to be different, because when you think about, all right, here's going to be a set of lessons that are going to be talking about marriage. You probably have a whole list of verses in your head that are, okay, he's going to talk about, he's going to start with, he's going to go back to, obviously we'll begin with Genesis, the second chapter, right, where marriage is established, where we first hear about that. That'll be probably the first thing he talks about. Nope. He went to Matthew, the 22nd chapter, and I can honestly tell you, no one has ever gone there in any kind of marriage class I've ever heard before, went to these verses to talk about how a marriage should be operated. And then what I thought was great about it was, it's not just about marriage, it's about everyday life. Every single thing we do hinges on these couple of little verses right here. So let's look at Matthew, the 22nd chapter, starting with verse 34. And let me put my eyes on so I can actually read. That'd be really great. So Matthew, the 22nd chapter, verse 34 says, "But when the Pharisees heard that he had silenced the Sadducees, they gathered together. Then one of them, a lawyer, asked him a question, testing him and saying," so here's a setup, another one of those setups for Jesus. "Teacher, which is the greatest commandment in the law?" Jesus said to them, and I'm going to guess again, they probably had some discussion about, here's the most important things here. Let's see what he says. They probably had an answer for whatever, which one he picked. We're going to attack him based on the one that he picked, because we're going to say something else is going to be more important. So we're going to challenge him on that. I'm going to guess they never thought he'd pull this one out. Okay. And what he pulls out, and he says, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, and all your mind." Who can argue with that? That has to be the greatest commandment. What is the sole duty of man? To fear God and keep His commandments. So we need to love God. That was number one. Again, you ever heard anybody use that as a reference for how your marriage should be run? I'd never heard that before in my life. I'm 48 years old. I've heard lots of lessons over those 48 years. Never heard that as a reference, a very first reference for here should be the basis of your marriage. This verse is that it is the sole duty of man to serve God, to love Him with all your, everything you've got. What I love about Jesus, though, Jesus, they only ask, what is the greatest commandment? They only ask for one. Jesus goes, let me throw a second one in here for free. Here's one you didn't ask about, and this is one you need to hear. And so He says, this, and the second is like this, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. That's not one they wanted to hear at all. Okay, I can have a relationship with God. And a lot of them probably thought that they did have a relationship with God that was perfectly fine. But then He talked about, you've got to love your neighbor as yourself. And we know that from looking at other teachings that He explained what He meant by neighbor. Because a lot of them go, okay, fine, I'm okay with my Pharisaical brothers. We're good. We can have a relationship. We're good there. And Jesus explained to them, that's not what we mean by neighbor. Okay? And actually, the one that He uses as a neighbor is going to be probably their greatest fear when He tells the story about the Good Samaritan. The worst of all possible examples you could pull out, I'm supposed to be a neighbor to him? That individual who is so far below me? So He uses this and says, you've got two things you need to do. You've got to love God with everything you've got, and you've got to love your neighbor. And everything you do, because He says, on these two commandments hang all the laws and the prophets. This is the basis for everything. So I loved that fact. And kind of going along with what George talked about in his sermon last week, when we look at these two sets of verses, they tell us being a Christian is about more than what most people will tell us. Most people will tell you, what does it mean to be a Christian? And they're going to give you a list of things that it is that you need to do. If you're going to be a Christian, you're going to have to check off these blanks here. And once you've got those things fulfilled, boom, you're a Christian. You're good with God. And what these set of verses tell us, it's no. You've got to have your, first of all, your heart's got to be right. If your heart's not right, everything else is wrong. This needs to be the foundation upon which you build everything else. It's a call to something greater than what most people would say. And what it bottom line tells us is, good isn't good enough. Because a lot of people say, I'm a good person. I do good things, but good's not good enough. It's about more than that. Why? What Brother Fontenot didn't do necessarily was, because again, he had a different topic, was talking, all right, God has told us that we need to love Him with all our heart, soul, and mind, everything we've got. Didn't necessarily go into a whole lot of why, because that wasn't his topic. But let's look at, why should I love God with everything that I have? Let's look at John 3:16. God tells us why we should love Him. In John the third chapter, the 16th verse says, for God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son, that whoever believes in Him should not perish, but have everlasting life. What this verse tells us is what God did, but not only tells us what God did, it tells us why He did it. What did He do? He gave the only Son He had to give. Why did He do it? Because He so loved the world. Why would He do that? Even though He loved us, why would He choose that sacrifice? Because if we will believe on Him, we can have everlasting life. What is God's goal for us? That we spend eternity in heaven with Him. And He's so strong on that goal. That is such an important goal to Him. He was willing to allow His Son to be sacrificed so that it can happen. Another verse to go along with that. Look at Romans the 5th chapter, please. And in Romans chapter 5, beginning with verse 6. Again, God tells us what He did and why He did it. So Romans chapter 5, verse 6. For when we were still without strength, in due time Christ died for the ungodly. For scarcely for a righteous man will someone die, yet perhaps for a good man someone would even dare to die. So what he's saying there is, people sacrificing their life for others, that's not a common thing. Doesn't happen very often. People aren't usually willing to give that up. But there might be a chance that for someone really good, someone might be willing to go, okay, I will sacrifice myself for you. But, verse 8, but God demonstrated his own love toward us in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. Much more then, having now been justified by his blood, we shall be saved from the wrath through God. Again, why should I serve God with everything I've got? Because what did God do for me? In this thing where we see that scarcely for a good person, someone might possibly be willing to die, God said, I'm going to do you one better while you're still a sinner. And nobody would die for those individuals. But while you're still a sinner, I'm going to send my son to die for you. He's going to sacrifice his life for you. So when God says, or when Jesus told them to, those are the two top two commandments. These are the two things you need to hinge everything on. Loving the Lord with all your heart, soul, and your mind. Loving your neighbor as yourself. Why should we do it? Because God so loved us that he sent his son. Even while we were sinners, he sent his son. That says, I am of value. That God valued me. But it doesn't just say that. It said God valued all of us. All of us who are his creation. And if God valued them, and he valued me to this level, I have to feel the same. I've got to adopt that same idea. So what does that mean? If I am to have this attitude about my brothers and my sisters, about my fellow man, about my neighbors, what does that mean about the life that I am supposed to live? It means I'm going to live a life that's going to be a little bit different than what the world tells us. And let's look at some examples. Let's go to Matthew, the fifth chapter. And George kind of went real quickly through these last parts of it, these points in his sermon last week, where he talked about, here's what the world will tell you, or here's even what the religious leaders will tell you. But here's the way that it ought to be. And bottom line here in Matthew, the fifth chapter, in these sets of verses here where he talks in the Sermon on the Mount, what is he saying? Doing good's not good enough. There is a whole lot more required of you than just simply doing good. So let's look and start with verse 20. Matthew, the fifth chapter, verse 20. For I say to you that unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven. You know that one had to sting. Because in the world where this sermon was delivered, those were the religious leaders. Those were the folks that you look to. Who's holier than they are? Especially if you ask them. And what he's saying is, if you don't have religion better than theirs, there's no hope for you. You need to have a more sincere faith than what they've got. So he sets things up with there. You're going to have to be different than they are. What they're doing isn't good enough. Were they doing good? Yeah, there were some good things that they were doing. But what he's saying is, not good enough. You've got higher requirements. There's more expected of you. And he goes on and says, you want to know how? Here's some stuff. So look at verse 21. You have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not murder, and whoever commits murder will be in danger of judgment. Is that a true statement? Are you not supposed to murder? True. Yes, that's a good thing not to do. Is it good enough? No. It goes more to my attitude about my brother than really what I ever actually do to them. And he goes on to say, but I say to you that whoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of judgment. Whoever says to his brother, Raka, shall be in danger of the council. Whoever says to his, you fool, shall be in danger of hellfire. What's he saying? My attitude towards my brother is important. I may never actually do anything to bring any harm to that person. Can I rejoice in the fact and go, yay, I never hurt anybody? Physically? Is that okay? No. It's more about your attitude. There are individuals. I'm thinking as Bill Cosby did a speech one time that actually got him in a lot of trouble with a lot of people. He was criticized highly for what he said. When he was asking individuals, because he spoke to an African-American audience, him being an African-American man, and said, we need to change the way we do some things. We need to have higher expectations for ourselves. And one of the things that he said was, there are individuals who will come up to you and say, I've never been in prison. And he goes, you're not supposed to be in prison. There's no reward in that. You're not supposed to go. Don't advertise that like that's something great you did. But okay, I'm better than my family because I didn't do that. No, you're simply doing what the right thing is to do. You know, well, I have a job and I take care of my family. I should be praised for it. No, you shouldn't. That's what you're supposed to do. In our world, we want to be praised for doing the right thing. You go, look, I'm so much better than the other people are. So what? That's what you're supposed to do. And the thing is, those things that we do, are they good enough? No, not if our attitude behind them isn't right. Is he done? Not even close. He keeps going. Therefore, if you bring your gifts to the altar and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift before the altar and go on your way. First be reconciled to your brother and then come and offer your gift. Again, scribes and Pharisees are going, what? What could be more important than sacrificing? Because that's a duty that we need to do. What Jesus is saying is, you need to work on that relationship first, then come back and do this. Is he done? Not even close. Agree with your adversary quickly while you're on the way, lest the adversary deliver you to the judge hand you over to the officer, and you be thrown in prison. Assuredly, I say to you, you will by no means get out of there till you have paid the last penny. He goes on. You have heard that it said to those of old, you shall not commit adultery. Is not committing adultery a good thing to do? Yes. Is it enough? Nope. Because he says, but I say to you that whoever looks at a woman to lust after for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. Again, it's about your attitude. You may never actually physically do anything, but if your mindset is wrong, you are not pleasing to God. He even goes on and says, 29, if your right eye causes you to sin, pluck it out and cast it from you. For it is more profitable for you that one of your members perish than for your whole body to be cast into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and cast it from you. For it is more profitable for you that one of your members perish than for your whole body to be cast into hell. Furthermore, it has been said, whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. He goes on then and talks about God has a manner by which divorce is supposed to happen. Number one, if it happens at all. And he doesn't say, here's your okay thing to do, but he's saying, if that is what happens, here's the only way in which it can happen correctly. The only way. Go to verse 33. Again, you have heard it said, you shall not swear, by those of old, verse 33, you shall not swear falsely, but shall perform your oaths to the Lord. But I say to you, do not swear at all, neither by heaven, for it is God's throne, nor by earth, for it is footstool, nor by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Nor shall you swear by your head, because you cannot make one hair white or black. But let your yes be yes, and your no be no, for whatever is more than these is from the evil one. Bottom line, what is he saying? Be an individual whose word can be trusted. And then this whole making an oath thing it's a non-issue. You don't need to worry about that. It doesn't make something more true if you swear to it. And there were a lot of these religious leaders who were going, because I swear by a particular thing, that then makes my word better. No, the word is right or the word is wrong based on whatever it is that you're saying, whether or not that is factual. If you're an honest individual, you don't have to worry about having something to back up what you've said. You have heard it said, verse 38, that an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, but I tell you not to resist an evil person. Here's an easy one to take care of, isn't it? Whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn them to the other also. If anyone wants to sue you and take away your tunic, let him have your cloak also. And whoever compels you to go 1 mile, go with him 2. Give to him who asks you, and from him who wants to borrow from you, do not turn away. You have heard that it is said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. Easy stuff to do. Is that enough? Nope. But I say to you, love your enemies. Is it enough to just care about my enemies? No. Because I have to do stuff for them. Because he says, bless those who curse you, do good to those who hate you, and pray for those who spitefully use you and persecute you, that you may be sons of your Father in heaven, for he makes his sun rise on the evil and on the good, and sends rains on the just and on the unjust. For if you love those who love you, what reward have you? Do not even the tax collectors do the same? And if you greet your brethren only, what do you do more than others? Do you even the tax collectors do so? Therefore you shall be perfect, just as your Father in heaven is perfect. Bottom line, what's it saying? It's good enough. No, God expects more from us. Why? Because God sent his Son to die on the cross for our sins, even while we were still sinners. And he expects us to love him with all of our heart, soul, and mind. Love our neighbor as ourself. We've got to treat people the way God expects us to treat people. We've got to do things the way God expects them to be done, even if that's not what the world says. Let's look at 1 Corinthians, the 11th chapter.